Hello, and welcome to Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. I'm your host, Robert Washburn. This program is coming to you from the Williams Treaty Territory and Northumberland 89.7 FM. For the next 30 minutes, we will bring you important stories and issues facing Indigenous and non-Indigenous people living here in Northumberland County and across the country. It is your chance to become better informed, more engaged, and empowered as we all move together on the path to reconciliation. So join us for the next step on this journey. It's great to have back Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson.
Thank you, Robert. It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
Can you describe for us the state of some Indigenous artifacts in Ontario?
Well, this is something I've been talking about a lot lately. It's on the hot burner for us right now. It's the fact that in almost 50 years, archaeologists who come across our artifacts do not have to give them over to First Nations. In fact, they do not have to give them over to museums. They are obligated to just keep them within their own holdings for the benefit of Ontario. So we are now having archaeologists that are storing artifacts in their garages, in their basements, in storage facilities. And then when these archaeologists, when they pass along, there is no requirement for them to be given to any authority. And oftentimes they get sold on eBay or they even end up in landfills.
Could you give us some examples of the things that you're aware of that would demonstrate what you're talking about?
Well, this is from the archaeologists themselves. They've sort of raised the alarm here where they're telling us that they just can't afford to store them. There are third-party for-profit storage facilities out there, but it's unfair to ask the archaeologists to store these artifacts for them when, in fact, they should be in-housed in First Nations. The vast majority of artifacts found in Ontario are of First Nations origin, and more specifically Anishinaabeg.
What was your reaction when you learned of this?
Well, I've got a background in anthropology, so I always knew that this was the case. I didn't realize the extent of it at the time. As someone that was into archaeology a little bit myself when I was in university, I knew that First Nations should have control of these artifacts, even if they didn't have the museum quality climate control facilities that the government says we should have before we take over these artifacts, because we know that they're not being currently stored like that in the archaeologist's basement.
Are there some examples of items related to Alderville?
Well, it's hard to say specifically because we are looking at items, artifacts, in some cases that are thousands of years old, upwards of 10,000 years old. So it's hard to say that those are specifically Alderville. But for the vast majority, we know that they are for Anishinaabe people. There's a little bit of Haudenosaunee. There's a little bit of Huron-Wendat, but the vast majority by far is Anishinaabe.
How is it that archaeologists can even do this?
Well, it's when you're an archaeologist, you're kind of looking for these items. It's your whole raison d'etre. It's why you got into this in the first place. So you have a passion for it. And the better you are, the more you're going to be finding. But the province of Ontario has not put in any requirement to house those in a proper way. So they just tell the archaeologist, you are now holding it in trust for the people of Ontario.
Is there even a database that identifies any of these things so that people can say, well, here's all the stuff that we do have?
No, this was a suggestion that I made where even if they are holding it, they should catalog, put it on this database that everyone can see. And if we say, hey, those are Anishinaabeg items, we would love to repatriate them into, say, our facility or at least into our box in our storage room, we feel like we should be the ones to be housing these.
But in the past, isn't this kind of stuff supposed to end up in a museum or in a library or a university? It's kind of hard to imagine why people keep them at their homes.
Yes. So I guess it gets down to that everywhere you dig in Ontario, you're going to find artifacts. And there's only so much space in the existing museums to house them. Even in the museum storage rooms, there's only so much space. So they are already overflowing and there really is no spot for them. So not only do the museums not know what's out there because they can't take them in, they're not going to where they should be in the first place. And this has been going on since 1975.
You alluded to this earlier, but what happens when someone dies? You were talking a bit about, can you just describe a little bit more in depth what is happening when someone passes away and the estate now handles these artifacts?
So the archaeologist, if they pass away, then that ends their requirement to hold these items in trust. So it's the executor of the state, perhaps their son or daughter, or a spouse who maybe not doesn't know too much about archaeology, and then they will stumble across these boxes in the garage. They don't know what they're about. It could just look like a bunch of rocks to them. So they do the best they can. In a perfect world, they would, you know, give us a call and say, "Hey, is there some of this that's Anishinaabe, and would you like to take a look at it?" But that often doesn't happen. Some people might see it as an opportunity to list items on eBay to make a little bit of money for themselves. So it's really it's the Wild West once that archaeologist passes away.
And then I can only imagine how difficult is it to track once that happens?
Well, it's incredibly difficult because presumably the archaeologist would have the context. They'd have all the drawings of when these were brought out of the ground, where they were brought, where they were found within each hole, within each pit. But when the archaeologist passes away, all that context is lost. And in a lot of ways, the artifacts become meaningless because they don't know where they came from. They don't know what time they're from. And without the context, it doesn't have a lot of archaeological purpose anymore.
To think that these items can end up being sold on the web or in a landfill, how does that make you feel?
Well, it's something that I've always known about. And same with treaties. Like if you look on eBay, you'll find a lot of old treaties. You'll find a lot of old artifacts, like information that belongs to not just Anishinaabe people, but Canadian people, the larger Canadian population. These are our history. These are our historical items, artifacts, documents, and they should be treated as such. I don't think that they should be on a black or gray market somewhere, you know, with someone who doesn't know what they are and just looking at them. It's very frustrating from my point of view to see this happening.
You've suggested items should go on a database to be tracked. Is that done anywhere else?
Well, Ontario is a little bit behind on all of this. So I think in the rest of Canada, for the most part, they are on top of this. I know Alberta is doing really well. So for some reason, Ontario is just in the dark ages when it comes to archaeological collections.
How effective is this, though, in terms of tracking things? Because, for example, I know that in the United Kingdom, there are many, many amateurs that go out and find things, and everything that they find has to be registered on a database that is nationwide. And then the British authorities then come back and say whether you can keep it or whether you have to give it to a museum or whatever. How sophisticated a system do you think we need here in Ontario?
Well, the system you just described is something I would love to see here in Ontario. In 2016, the provincial government made a 5-year commitment to sitting down with us and having these discussions about how we would like to see the artifacts treated.
What happened to that?
Nothing happened to that. So here we are 8 years later, and there hasn't been one iota of progress.
I understand there are more than 500 sites registered with the Ontario government, yet the artifacts found on these sites are being held by archaeologists. Now, are archaeologists to blame for this situation? Who do you think is responsible?
I wouldn't blame the archaeologists. In a lot of ways, they are they're trying to document the past. They're trying to put puzzles together. And if they've got an open mind, they might sometimes be rewriting the history of the territory. So I think that's any archaeologist's goal. They have a mind of academia. They want to find the truth, ideally, and they just want to put all the historical pieces together. So they are going about and doing that. But the rest of the system hasn't caught up to where they're at.
Okay, so when you talk about the system, whose feet are you placing this at?
Well, I would say it's the Ministry of Multiculturalism for the most part. They're the ones that made these promises that they were going to solve the problem and get it back to us. Back then, it was the Ministry of Tourism, Culture, and Sport. So now it's the Ministry of Citizenship and Multiculturalism. So they would be the ones I'd be looking at to come to the table and sit down with us to come up with a solution.
Now, you signed a letter about this issue. What was the response that you got from it?
It was a thank you for your concern. We will get back to you basically when we want to. That was pretty much it.
What other pressures can you apply to this to get some sort of movement?
Well, we did an interview with the Globe and Mail. It was actually a cover story a couple of weeks ago. And then shortly after that, CBC picked it up and I was on one of their radio show programs talking about it. And at the time, the ministry hadn't got back to them, but then they updated and said that, you know, they're doing everything they can. They're committed to sitting down with us and they've already done these amazing things, which is a bit of a slap in the face because we know they haven't.
Let's not forget the development in Brighton as an example of heritage protection. You and I have talked about this before on this podcast, but is there any updates you can provide us and anything around the efforts in Northumberland to update policies locally to respect what you've talked about today?
Well, I think we have to be able to do what we can. And in this case, when we're looking at the local politicians, I would urge them to reach out to us. So then you get that relationship building from community to community. So I would definitely encourage that to go forward. But again, their hands are tied because it's the province that is the one that has the mandate to regulate these issues.
So what's next?
Well, I'm going to hope that I eventually get a letter from the ministry that says they want to sit down with me and they want to talk about these important issues and let's get it going. Let's start that 5-year process now, 8 years later.
Thank you for talking to us about this important subject.
Thank you.
Please stay tuned to hear more conversations towards reconciliation with Tainar Simpson. This is Northumberland 89.7 FM, your local source for news and information. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I hope you're enjoying our chat today. I'm Robert Washburn, and I'm here with Tainar Simpson, the chief of Alderville First Nations. We are so glad you're joining us. I'd like to begin by talking about Orange Shirt Day and the National Day of Truth and Reconciliation, which takes place on September 30th. I know the awareness around Orange Shirt Day and Truth and Reconciliation are more familiar to many people. But there are those who are unsure. Could you give us a refresher on what it is and its significance?
So Orange Shirt Day was brought about when Phyllis Webstad started sharing her story of how when she was young and being shipped off to residential school, she had a different opinion of what residential school was compared to what it actually was. So she went shopping and she got a bunch of new clothes. She was given some stuff and she had one shirt that was her favorite and that was an orange shirt. And then when she checked into the residential school, well, not checked in, when she was processed in the residential school, they took all of her belongings and one of them was the orange shirt, which she never saw again. And then she just talked about how she loved that orange shirt and that it should be something that, you know, not a story that should have been repeated, but it was, of course, something that was repeated hundreds of thousands of times in the course of residential schools in Canada.
Thanks for retelling that story. But what is the significance to us? Why do, at the end of this month, are we going to honor and commemorate Orange Shirt Day and Truth and Reconciliation?
Well, I think the main point is to spread that message of reconciliation. And ultimately, it's to make sure something like this never happens in Canada again, because it's not like we're at some great point in our history where it's unfathomable that this could happen again. We are just on the cusp of hearing all these things that other people are saying. There's a lot of denialism. So we are very close to being able to potentially revert back to a system where these things were allowed to happen in the first place.
I'd like to talk to you about young people, the children and youth who are growing up as a generation where this kind of recognition is more prevalent as a part of their education. What changes have you witnessed over the years between what students are learning today versus what you and your generation were learning?
Well, I think when I was a student many moons ago, the history of First Nations wasn't taught very well. I was led to believe we were savages. We killed people for fun. We were just a bloodthirsty gang of marauders, basically. And then I would listen to other kids' speeches on Indigenous people, and they were even worse than what you'd been taught. So I found every time I said that, "Hey, I'm Indigenous," well, we used the word Indian back then, it would just be opening up ridicule, and it would be an invitation for people to insult First Nations people and the individual saying it. So I don't think that it's quite as bad today. We know that bullying still exists, but overall, there's a new way of understanding for Indigenous people in this country.
I understand you speak to classes. What is your experience in the classroom?
Well, when I guess it was even before Orange Shirt Day, before the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, I was speaking in the classes from anywhere from junior kindergarten all the way up to university level graduate programs. And I was shocked that no one really knew about these schools. It was like I was saying everything for the first time. And of course, the difficult part is being age appropriate for these children. So if you're in kindergarten, you really shouldn't be learning about the horrors of the school, but you should know that kids were made to go to school and they didn't get to see their parents. And it's part of our past and it's part of what Canada is. And then even in high school, you wouldn't want to get into the worst of it. Even though they've got a greater sense of how things went, I would say that it's not until you get to university level courses that you can really start telling people what happened. And even at that point, I wouldn't want to say everything that that we know happened.
Can you give us any examples of the types of things that you actually did say so that people could get a sense of how you talk about it?
Well, I think that the main thing is to understand that children were removed from their homes at the age of 6, sometimes earlier, and then over the next 10 years they wouldn't see their parents again. Maybe on Christmas they'd be sent home, but even at then the residential schools discourage that. So you were gone from your family, your culture, your home for over 10 years, and by the time you came back, you had lived like two-thirds of your life in a residential school, and going back home was foreign to you, so you became a foreigner in your own environment.
How do the students that you're speaking to respond when you talk to them about this? What are co their reactions?
I think it's mostly shock. I've never seen someone say, "That's not true, that never happened." I think that's understanding that I've got over 25 years of experience in this as a researcher. They know that I know what I'm talking about. So I find that it's refreshing that everyone's like, "I can't believe this happened. This is awful." And they really want to learn more. So that's a really good sign.
What about in Alderville? What gets taught to the youth in your community?
Well, I think our youth are very well aware. They are knowledgeable about the issues. We've got a lot of programming. We've been bringing back the culture. We have drum groups. We have regalia making groups. We put a lot of stock into the powwow and the powwow cycle. So we really try to push our youth towards culture and language. In fact, we have an intensive Anishinaabe Mohan course being taught in the community, and that's something that's ongoing as well too. So you can really get into the language and basically learn from the past that way.
But what about recognizing what took place at the residential schools? What gets taught to them about that aspect?
Well, I think that's a really good question, because in a lot of ways we feel like they're kind of getting it through osmosis, I'd say, because we have parents that know about this. So it's something that parents can teach their kids in the home. Whereas, outside of a reserve, the parents don't know what happened. So they're not really teaching them in the home about these issues. So I think in a lot of ways, it's just part of who we are. It's like liking Scone dogs, we just all have grown up with it, that we understand and we know.
How do they talk about it, though, as young people, when they discuss it and they're opening up about how they feel and react?
Well, I think, the good thing is that they see it as a historical fact now. So it's something that was in the past. They can't believe it happened. They find it hard to comprehend that these type of horrors and evil actions could have happened. So that was always what I wanted, because when I first got into this, the last residential school had just closed. So it wasn't history. It was a modern fact. There was lots of people who were younger than me that were had gone through this. So I like now that they see it as a historical thing and something that's beyond their comprehension, because that's where we want it to be. But at the same time, they know what happened. They know that this is the country we live in, and there's still a lot of work to do.
What then is the takeaway for the rest of the community when they see the young people learning about this aspect of their history? How do they respond?
I think it's good. I think it's overall healing. So sometimes you want to target a specific demographic, but it ends up helping everybody. So I think our community, that even though we have a lot of residential school survivors, for the most part, we were spared the worst of it. We had a Indian Day School here in Alderville. So that was like the lesser of the two evils. So most of our elders went to the Indian Day School. So even then, it's hard for some people to understand really what happened at these residential schools.
What difference do you think all this will make in the future when it comes to young people learning about residential schools now?
Well, I think that every year it gets better, because we're more and more students are going through the curriculum that teaches this in school, and that eventually we'll have university graduates that learn right from the very beginning about these schools. And once you have a proper understanding, you're able to come up with proper solutions, and then maybe put in those safeguards to make sure something like it doesn't happen again. I know I say that over and over again, but it really is something that we can't let happen in this country again.
We now come to one of our favorite parts of our show, and that is our public service announcements. What have you got on track for this month?
Well, there's a few things we've got on the go for this month. So I would ask everyone to look on the Alderville app, because we have a community priority survey with an October 31st deadline. So this is where you would like to see the community focus on priorities. Like, do you see it as education? Do you see it as culture? Do you want more housing? So it's just a chance for everyone to say what they would like to see. Also going on right now is wild rice season. So we have Jeff Beaver, who's been going to all of the locations, checking on the rice, seeing how close it is being harvested. And we do have a lot of rice on the way. And in fact, Rice Lake is starting to have its own good rice bed finally coming up. It's bigger than it's been since probably the 1930s. Also coming up in October, we have a firearms and hunting certification. So if you're interested in getting into traditional hunting or anything like that, please come down to the community center or the band office and sign up for it. And of course, the Black Oak Savannah has been really busy putting together Seasons of the Turtle, which is an exploration of Alderville First Nation in 13 moons. And that's being shown at the Workworth Awe Center. And so that goes on till October 6th. So I was there last weekend. I didn't realize the Workworth Fair was going on, so it was hard to find parking, but it was just really incredible. There's 13 artworks, and they're all done by Alderville artists, and each one of them is of the 13 moons. There are 13 moons in the lunar calendar. So it was just really nice to see people that I didn't even know were artists have put together beautiful artwork for this. So we're really happy with that. And of course, we have our Kids in the Kitchen programming. So if you want your kids to learn how to cook, we have September and October Kids in the Kitchen classes going on. So please contact the Health and Social Services Center if you are interested.
I want to thank Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson for talking to me today. I want to thank you for joining our conversation. And I hope you enjoyed this time to learn more about what's going on, the stories and issues facing Indigenous people living in Northumberland and elsewhere. That's all for this week. I'm Robert Washburn. Join us again next time for Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Tainar Simpson.